Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your omnium gatherum of music news and list making. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff. I'm mad, but I ain't stressing. True friends, one question. Where you and I was walking, now I run a game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta, everybody wanna cut the legs off him. Kunta, black man taking no losses. Oh yeah. Where you and I was walking. Today we have all convened to talk about the best records of 2015. Hello, gentlemen. Nate Chinen, John Pareles, John Caramonica.
Ayo.
We're going to do this in stages because we can't talk about 40 records. We're going to talk
Speak
about...
Speak for yourself, man.
We have quite different lists. A couple of connector pieces, but mostly quite different lists this year. We're going to talk about our individual number ones. We're going to talk about outliers in our own lists, and we're going to talk about, the things that made our lists, our individual lists, cohere.
Hey, if they did.
Which gets to the center of what 2015 in non-classical music was all about.
All right. We were going to talk about the year of classical music.
No.
Oh, I totally prepped wrong.
Non-classical.
Oh, my God.
Nate Chinen, what was your number one?
My number one was Synovial Joints, a record by the alto saxophonist and composer Steve Coleman with a large ensemble he calls the Council of Balance.
So Steve Coleman has made a lot of records. Well, for the last 10 years or so, he's been on a kind of hot streak. I mean, he sort of re-energized his career, and he won a MacArthur Award. What is it about this record that seems special to you?
This was an album that really included a lot of strands of ideas that he has been exploring. And there's so much going on. And by some miracle of arrangement and execution, it all feels organic and light and propulsive and engaging. It really could have gone at least three or four other ways that would not have been half as appealing. But there's Brazilian and Afro-Cuban percussion, there's chamber strings, there are brass and woodwinds. There's a lot of elements, and including members of his core band, the Five Elements. It's just a really marvelous kind of synthesis of all of these different things that he's been exploring. And it feels utterly contemporary, and it also feels in some ways like a summation of a life's exploration.
So let's hear a little bit of the Steve Coleman record, Synovial Joints. We'll hear Synovial Joints 2, Hip and Shoulder. John Pareles, what was your number one album of the year?
My number one was Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly, which is the most wildly ambitious album in the non-jazz realm, I guess. He tried to take on a lot. He tried to take on culture. He tried to take on his career. He tried to take on changing the world. He tried to take on not being a jerk, all these things. But also, it's like your Steve Coleman album, I guess, it's intensely layered. It's densely layered. It's got P-funk. It's got G-funk. It's got jazz. It's got dialogue. It's got pop songs. It doesn't have a whole lot of hooks, except for All Right. But you just felt like you were immersed in this entire environment. It's a virtual reality record just waiting for, you know, your three-dimensional visualization to float through your head. And it was also an album as an album. You really wanted to listen to it from end to end and just get immersed in it. It wasn't something you addressed casually. But to me, it's just the most towering cultural achievement in music this year.
So from To Pimp a Butterfly by Kendrick Lamar, we will hear All Right.
We gon' be all right. Right.
And when I wake up, I recognize you looking at me for the pay cut. Bahamas, I be looking at you from the face down. One Mac 11, even boom with the bass down. Skimming, and let me tell you about my life. Painkillers only put me in a twilight. We're pretty.
John Caramonica, your number one album of the year, please.
My number one album of the year is not an album. It's an oeuvre.
Mm-hmm.
It's the work of Future.
What, the whole thing?
Just everything, man. It's DS2, the three mixtapes, it's What a Time to Be Alive, the collaboration with Drake. It's all of those things.
But conveniently, he did put out a record this year called DS2.
He did, but I feel like DS2 is a distillation of ideas that he'd been working on in the mixtapes that he'd been putting out since last October,
mm-hmm.
when I thought hard about what I wanted to place at number one, and putting DS2 as a standalone felt sort of incomplete. In my mind, he sort of engaged in like a multi-part project that's all one idea.
Mm-hmm.
This is Future in sort of drug-addled meltdown mode, but also like just outrageously arrogant and confident, but full of a voice full of decay, but also melodically as strong as like any R&B singer.
Well, do you feel like he's able to sort of enact his control even in settings that are not entirely his?
Yes, that's the thing. The thing that's most striking about this year is when you listen to the Future and Drake record, What a Time to Be Alive, which is also part of my number one, Drake is by far the more popular person, and you could almost say has the more established aesthetic, and certainly the more established aesthetic arc.
But it's
that's
very,
a Future record.
It's a very Future-y record.
It's not a Drake record. It's a Future record.
Yeah.
That is both a testament to the sort of sure-footedness of Future's ideas. It's also a testament to Drake's savvy, but it's really about Drake savvy enough to stand on that platform.
So from Future's DS2, we will hear Thought It Was a Drought.
We got purple, this I thought it was a drought. Bitch, I'ma choose dirty over you. You know I ain't scared to lose you. They don't like it when you're telling the truth. I'd rather be realer than you. I had to make me a cut, and I called a contractor to make me a spot. I sold a dip out your house, now you come to my house, I got dip in the couch. You know I don't fool, no rumors. Rockin' red bottoms like they boomers. Got these meds on me, I'm a doom. I take these and I'm having a thrill. Taking prescriptions, a hell of a feeling. Ask with the Xanny, I never forgot it. Got them big and they callin' my phone, tryna have a menage. Gotta put up the cash, can't even stay in the house, cause it's too much.
My favorite album of the year was The Epic by Kamasi Washington, who's a jazz band leader in Los Angeles. And he made this triple album with a group of musicians that he's been playing with since he was a teenager, most of them. It's an extremely long record. It's nearly 3 hours long. And it's also dense and ambitious. And it involves not only a 10-piece band, but also an orchestra in sections and a choir. And what was very interesting about this album this year, aside from the fact that it seemed to be the one jazz album that most people who are sort of into music of any kind had even heard of, was that this was a kind of jazz arrival the way it's supposed to happen in a band setting, a band that's been playing over and over, refining its thing, mostly in the same spots in Los Angeles week after week for years. And they sort of have this intuitive communication among them. And I saw them several times before the album came out, and it was, well, if I can say it, it was even better than the record. But just the looseness and the communication is really at sort of level 10 with this group. And then they, you know, unloaded this major work, which had a coherence to it because it's a collective and not just a figurehead spewing out his leader ideas for 3 hours. It's a huge album, but there's a coherence to it. So from that record, The Epic by Kamasi Washington, we'll hear the track called The Next Step.
So Ben, I kind of feel like a coastal traitor. You picked a Los Angeles-based jazz collective. I picked Kendrick Lamar, very Los Angeles. I've got a lot of other Los Angeles on my list. Mm-hmm. And here I am, a New Yorker for life. Are we traders or are we just picking the good stuff?
Yeah, what is happening in Los Angeles? Because I found, I mean, when I was looking at my list as sort of a total package, there's three Southern California records on my list. Mm-hmm. There's Kendrick, Vince Staples, who's from Long Beach, mm-hmm. and Ty Dolla Sign, who's from Los Angeles. It really got me thinking a lot about where musicality is in contemporary pop and hip-hop and R&B. I feel like the most robust production and the sort of most clever sonic ideas are coming from California. Mm-hmm. And this has been true for probably a couple of years, but you think about the DJ Mustard sound that's been so popular sort of in a national sense, there's lightness to that. The stuff that I found myself attracted to this year was the opposite of that. I mean, this is all very like lush, orchestrated, full, very, very thick music.
Yeah.
Even the Ty Dolla Sign record, I mean, Ty Dolla Sign comes out of the Mustard side of the universe, but this record feels like a mid to late 70s soul record. I mean, admittedly, it's all about sleeping with multiple women in various positions and locations, but sort of texturally and ideologically, it feels like a late 70s.
That stuff
record.
Was happening in the 70s.
That's true. I wasn't there, and but I'll take your word for it.
That's something that Ty Dolla Sign's record doesn't have in common with the Kendrick Lamar.
No, it does. And, I feel like it does have in common with Vince and Kendrick. It doesn't have in common with like the Mustard side. I would have previously put Ty Dolla Sign sort of on the Mustard side of the LA universe,
which is to say sparse.
Yes, almost glib in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But even he, there was some interview I read with him where he's like, after I heard To Pimp a Butterfly, like I knew I was heading in the right direction on mm-hmm. my album,
mm-hmm.
which like on its face seems a little ridiculous given what Ty Dolla Sign talks about generally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But when you listen to Free DC, actually makes weirdly a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, there just seems to be something that's going on in Los Angeles, and to have you pick, you know, you're talking about Kamasi, and we know that Kamasi and Kamasi's crew is very heavy on Kendrick's work.
Mm-hmm.
That city feels probably the most exciting of any city right now in mm-hmm. terms of its music culture.
And I ended up putting Joanna Newsom, who's out there in California. I ended up putting Miguel on my list, mm-hmm. also an album about LA.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's the low rents. Maybe it's the fact that
are they low? I don't know if they're low anymore.
Low in New York. Maybe they have time and leisure while they're driving those endless miles to think about their music.
Does it feel like geospatial to anybody in a way? Like the nature of the music? You know, I mean, not to be all determinist about it.
No,
but like,
I think that's real. Open spaces in a place translating into open spaces in music. I think that's real.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the fact of Vince and Kendrick being adamant with their personae of I'm not going to be fake. I'm going to be as true to myself as I can be.
Just the thing to do in Hollywood.
It's very anti-Hollywood.
You
same
can
with
also,
the Earl record.
For this, yeah, I was going to say you can add Earl into this conversation for that purpose. What's really striking, I mean, this was an interesting year for gangster rap. You know, if you look at the Straight Out of Compton, the return of Dr. Dre, the idea of gangster rap sort of re-entering the pop consciousness. We've gotten very far, you know, we're in the Drake era. We've gotten very far away from sort of like tough talk, street-oriented rap. And what Kendrick and Vince did, Earl is a different proposition in this case, but what Kendrick and Vince did is basically take the idea of gangster rap, which is sort of previously like a macro idea about big picture stuff in society and your neighborhood and da-da-da, and they sort of they made it a little bit smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Vince is very much a first-person storyteller. Mm-hmm. Not that he's not touching on big ideas, but it's doing a lot of first-person work. Kendrick is obviously talking about big picture black creativity in America, police brutality, various issues. But he's doing it through the lens of himself.
Right. He's a bit more grandiose, but he's not saying that he's got the answers.
No, he's indicting himself.
He is indicting
himself. I mean, this is something in Vince as well. And
yeah.
These are people who are basically coming out of a gangster rap tradition in terms of subject matter, but are reframing it for basically, not to be all trite about it, but of a social media era of I. They're shrinking it down to make it individual and pocket-sized.
Mm.
And that's what was most striking to me, more about the Vince record. I mean, to me, you guys all had Kendrick near the top of your list. To me, the Vince record is more effective because I find him to be a sleeker and more targeted storyteller. Mm-hmm. I sometimes feel like Kendrick is overflowing and not in the kind of like, oh, it's all majestic. Like sometimes I'm like, yo, fam, like 20% of this could have gotten left on the cutting room floor and like no one would have been any the wiser.
Mm-hmm. But I like the sprawl of Kendrick's album. I like the fact that there's so many instruments and things going on piled onto it. I mean, I really like getting lost in that music. The Vince is much more linear. I like immersive music in general. It's one of my bad habits. But that's what drew me to Kendrick instead.
There's another thing about Los Angeles and, you know, obviously Hollywood, especially, you know, this idea that it's sort of our dream center, our national incubator and factory and distribution center for narrative and for stories. Mm-hmm. I think that when you look at Kamasi's record, you know, he calls it the epic. He has a kind of grand narrative that motivated the way that he structured the album. It's not really important that you understand it to get into the music. Kendrick's album feels very much like something that had cinema in mind as he was putting it together. At moments, it plays out like a movie. You know, there's an album that I thought for a while would be on my list, and it didn't end up making it there. This record by Laura Marling, where she talks about California. She talks about sort of socially what's going on there and how it made her feel. You know, and I just feel like there's so much energy to the ways in which image and story and perception, there's something sort of palpable about them when you're in LA and when you're living in LA. And, you know, that might be something that played out in these lists.
Well, also, John Caramanica, you had Lana Del Rey's album.
Oh, God, yeah.
Pure Jeez. Hollywood.
Oh, my gosh.
I was thinking about that one myself.
Yeah, and in a weird way, you can almost make the case quietly that The Weeknd's album fits into this, because this is the album where he, like, basically accepts his fate as a famous person and, like, all the things that come with it. And I think
out in the hills.
Yeah, and a lot of it was recorded in California, and certainly a lot of the ideas for it were generated in California. I do think Lana, for sure, the scope of her storytelling is both Los Angeles-sized and Los Angeles-shaped, which is certainly what has her in the same company as Kendrick and Kamasi, I would say. I don't know. I'm just very, very struck with how little work of this level of density and ambition is coming out of New York in really any genre. And I don't know how much of that is structural. I don't know how much of that has to do with, like, there aren't really studios here anymore, and et cetera, et cetera. Like, I don't know how much of it is that and how much of it is just that New York's moment was sort of fixed somewhere in the 80s or 70s or 90s, depending what your sort of genre preference is. And there hasn't necessarily been, apart from like the new rock of the early 2000s, there hasn't been like a real legit movement to come out of the city since then. Mm-hmm. Most of the good records that you hear that are New York records are sort of self-consciously reviving an old idea in the last few years. That's, you know, the New York records I like the most seem to be just sketches of earlier New York records. Mm-hmm. But in Los Angeles, maybe there's just less, the burden of history is much lighter, perhaps.
Now that we've talked about L.A., we can talk about just non-New York. I mean, there were a couple of jazz records on my list that had to do with New York. But other than that, that's it. I mean, empires wax and wane, don't they? I remember having conversations about rock in New York in the early and mid-90s, saying, like, where is it? There's nothing here. There's nothing here. Then all of a sudden there was a whole lot here.
Or so we were led to believe.
So we were led to believe.
Our friends at Vice convinced us.
But then it moves on.
It's not just that it moves on, but where is the sort of generative impulse for a new thing? Every now and then I find myself in conversation with a producer, a young rapper, or a young artist, and they sort of like, oh, I want to bring New York back. I want to. The ideas generally stop at, well, it used to be like this, and like, why can't it be like this anymore?
Yeah.
And the thing that I always try to emphasize to those people is like, it's never going to be like that. Like the fact that you're even having this conversation with me, talking about how much you loved 1977, 1984, 1994, 2002, the fact that we're even having that conversation indicates a sort of failure on your part. These are fun conversations, obviously. Mm-hmm. But basically, like, you should basically be here telling me you have some new thing. Mm-hmm. Like, you want to beat the kids in Atlanta. You want to beat the kids in L.A. You want to beat the kids in London. Like, that's That's right. What the emphasis should be on.
Right.
But I don't feel, broadly speaking, much of that coming from New York. Even if you look in the sort of Bushwick scenes and stuff like that, like, it doesn't necessarily feel the most groundbreaking. Mm-hmm. And maybe L.A. with its space and its sprawl, and it's kind of like almost really low level of broader commitment. Like, you can just sort of be like you're saying about Kamasi, like, it's the guy who plays a local gig twice a week with his buddies and they have time to figure it out. Mm-hmm. New York, that's not really – is that happening here right now? I just don't know if it is.
It's happening among jazz guys?
Is it?
No, in jazz the cycle is – you have your social circle and then your concentric circles around it. You form your project, you know, maybe you get your grant from Chamber Music America or whatever. You work the project in clubs and then you take it on tour. And you spend a third of the year in Europe and Asia and then you come back and work on the next one. So New York is the beneficiary because we get to see the stuff as it's workshopped or for its big debut. But it's not album cycles as much as it is kind of there's a project that has a life cycle and there are institutional support apparatus.
Isn't it very much like New York's like a little bit more of a gig economy than when it comes to music? I think in LA you can probably live a little bit more cheaply while you're figuring it out. Yeah. And like there's less pressure of like, oh, I got to go play at this kid's bar mitzvah.
There are fewer proper gigs for jazz musicians in Los Angeles. But that doesn't mean there aren't places to play. The Kendrick record, I've run into people from the jazz world who would like to argue that To Pimp a Butterfly is essentially a kind of jazz album.
I mean, I don't disagree with that.
I don't agree with it. I can see why someone would say that. There is something in its bloodstream that is related to jazz.
I feel like we should maybe talk about some other themes that popped up within different lists. Ben, a thing that I notice about your list is I feel like a bunch of the records are in spirit, if not literal, DIY records.
Mm-hmm.
That could be anything from sort of a lo-fi approach to a DIY distribution. I look at my list and there's a lot of like really produced stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I look at your list and there's a lot of scrappy stuff.
It's true that there was a lot of stuff on my list that was definitely made on the cheap. We're talking about, for example, the singer Jen Hsu's record, Sounds and Cries of the World, which was made first by her own sort of ethnomusicological research, taking a microphone around the world, investigating ritual cultures, and then bringing that stuff back home and, you know, working with a highly capable bunch of improvisers and just banging out the record quickly. And then Ava Roche from this very interesting sort of post-rocky experimental scene in Rio. A bunch of people, many of them recording for a small label called Quintavant, although this record is not. It's a record you can get for free from her website. It's small scale but ambitious, like a lot of these things. Tenement is another example of the same thing. Basically a sort of pop punk band, although I think they abominate that term, from Appleton, Wisconsin, who have been at the center of a kind of DIY punk scene in their own little hometown and, you know, made this record, this amazing long double record over a long period of time and cheaply. And it's just like there's so much great boiled down rock writing on it and others too. So it's a process of there's just so much DIY music now that it has to be better. There's nothing interesting about DIY in and of itself. I mean, I'm sure you spent a long time on Bandcamp this year.
Yeah, sure, of course. It's a lot of noise.
It's a lot, man.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
It's a lot.
I spent more time going through Bandcamp this year than last year.
Sure. Yeah,
I mean, it's fascinating.
But it's a thicket.
It's stultifying
and fascinating. On the production side, there are lower and lower barriers to quality as you're setting out to make your own music, right? And the tools are more sophisticated and arguably studio, like proper studios, if you're making a certain kind of album and you don't need a room sound, like a band room sound, who needs a studio?
Oh, there's probably a plugin for that anyway.
Right.
There's probably
there's
an app
definitely
store.
A plugin.
Turn on the filter.
$2.99. This is probably super cheap. Yeah, I mean, I think what you're saying is right. Like DIY, quad DIY is like not inherently that. That's why I'm always like a little bit skeptical when people are referring to scenes, like modern scenes that mm-hmm. are DIY scenes, because mm-hmm. I'm just like, yeah, but isn't mm-hmm. that just like anybody? Like it doesn't feel, it well, used to have like a political component and a social component, and I think it sure. less and less indicates that.
No, now it's just the toys that we own.
Yeah, it's just, it's like I'm just in my house. What I got.
Well, when it comes down to record making,
that's
what it is.
Yeah, of course. One other theme that I want to talk about, JP, actually, on your list, I feel like your list maybe skews a little bit auteurist.
Well, yeah, I mean, concept albums for sure. I mean, mm-hmm. Joanna Newsom's album is Divers, she's called it a concept album. It's all about time and mortality and love and war. But all the songs are shards of the same basic ideas. Not so much musically, but rhetorically. The Miguel album is his panorama of L.A. The Kendrick album, obviously, is an epic.
And Bjork.
Yeah, Bjork is the chronicle of a heartbreak. I guess I was drawn, actually, to albums that worked as albums instead of albums that had the hit single that popped out and you put up with the rest of it.
The Bjork album sits at the sort of Venn diagram center of the auteurist and DIY.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Maybe it's just, there's more of a sense now of if you're going to make an album at all, it should have import, it should have a soul, it should have a concept.
It should at least have scope. It shouldn't just be like the last 12 songs you recorded. I mean, even the Adele album, which is on my list, she said she threw out half the songs she wrote for it. And on her previous two albums, they were basically most of the songs she wrote at all.
Or like the R. Kelly statement that he wrote something like 435 songs, you know, for this new record.
I mean, not on our lists, I don't think.
No, it's not. He's definitely not on my list.
Maybe if he picked a different 12.
Yeah, no, the other 400.
But does this new drive that we're noticing to make records more special, to land more heavily, does that have to do with changing listening habits?
Part of it is we're critics. You know, we want to make the bigger picture out of it. And it's easier to make a bigger picture out of an album than it is out of a scrapbook.
Well, there's different kinds of albums. I mean, the Ray Shremmerd album is an example of a new artist makes a big splash through a single track, however they do it. You know, YouTube, social media, like whatever is the way in. And if it's big enough, after that, an album will sort of have to follow. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah, but in my mind, what's interesting about the Ray Shremmerd album is like I feel like almost any of the songs on it mm-hmm. could have functioned as that first song. I mean, mm-hmm. No Flex Zone was like an incredible single and a great jumping off point, but there's easily 7 or 8 smash records on that. I mean, they're totally consistent in the sense that they all are like youthful and like a little bit internet-y and da da da, but they're not a tonal consistency. There's not a wholeness. You can argue for it as an album the way that you argue for To Pimp a Butterfly or Summertime 06 or any of these other folks. But as sort of an end-to-end banger, as we used to say, for my money, you can't beat the Ray Shremmerd record. Mm-hmm. Also like to salute my brothers in arms at Complex Magazine, who I know agree with me on this.
So now we will talk about something on each of our lists that was kind of a wild card. Nate, what was yours?
Well, since we're talking a little bit about, you know, what constitutes an album, and also for that matter, Los Angeles, there's an album, and I use that term with intent, called The Seasons by a tenor saxophonist and bassoonist named Ben Wendell. Ben Wendell is in a band called Kneebody that's fairly popular. He's also a session musician and a touring musician who's worked with a whole lot of people from, I think, Snoop Dogg to Daedalus, the electronic producer. He has put out conventional albums in conventional ways, but for this, he decided to post one video every month with a different duet partner and a different piece of music that he had composed for that duet partner. And the videos are shot in all different locations. There's a really nice production value. They're interesting, and they're really varied. You know, he works with musicians that are in his immediate peer group, and he also works with people who are more like influences on him, Joshua Redman and Mark Turner, two tenor saxophonists that I think you would put in the short list of his precursors. Each of those musicians turns up. You know, I just thought it was really engaging, a really interesting solution to the idea of how do you get people to be engaged with your music and continue to be engaged. You know, this was something that every month there would be a little moment on social media. You know, who is it going to be? You know, we didn't know who the partners were. We didn't know what direction the music was going to go in. So it's just a really smart chamber-like idea that used sort of our media environment to its advantage.
So from Ben Wendell's YouTube series,
why don't we hear seasons? April?
We'll hear April,
which features the drummer Eric Harland.
John Pareles, what was an outlier on your list?
My wild card was Mbangwana Star, which is a band from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The album's called From Kinshasa. It's a Congolese band with a producer who's an Irish DJ who is billed as a band member. And Congolese music has always been this crazy paradox because it's the happiest, most joyful three-chord rumba you ever heard, and it's coming from this place that's had decades of horrible civil war. And this band, with their producer, put darkness into the music. And the way they did it was to record world music the way world music isn't recorded. World music is usually recorded, let's put the band in the room and make the mics sound as natural as possible and capture this moment of the way the band plays in the club. And instead, what their producer, fully with their collusion, did was to make this a crazy sonic minefield and funhouse where the mix changes every 20 seconds. You have very tiny sounds amplified way up. You have weird echoes coming out. It's dubbed out. It's technofied. And yet the core of it is still live musicians, great African musicians. So you have these weathered African voices, this extremely hot rhythm section, and you have all this sonic madness going on, and it really makes you think you're walking through streets where anything can pop out of a dark alley at any moment.
So from that album by the Congolese band Mbangwana Star, we'll hear the song Susanna.
Susanna.
John Caramonica, what was the weirdo on your list?
The record I want to talk about was my number 10 record, which is by Colleen, and it is called Captain of None. It's on Thrill Jockey. Colleen is a French musician who plays an instrument called the treble viola da gamba, which is a Baroque period instrument. The instrument is made by a modern luthier, but it's most associated with the Baroque period. She plays it, filters it through any number of pedals or technological assisted methods, and makes a sound that, when I first heard it, was so sort of befuddling, but instantly recognizable, even though I didn't understand anything that was happening. I just kept coming back to it over and over again. And actually, when I was putting my list together, I spent a lot of time thinking about, why are we choosing these albums? And I feel like a thing that often comes up is like, oh, it's the albums I like return to the most over the course of the year, or something that sort of privileges some kind of a longitudinal approach to quality, or premises quality upon like a longitudinal approach of longitudinal value.
Sure. Rather than something that you can only hear once and never want to go back to it again, but it was really good.
Or what I chose to do this year, partially consciously, partially unconsciously, is I feel like I'm very in touch with how I felt the first moment I heard a thing that I had not previously heard. Mm-hmm. And the first moment I heard this Colleen record, I did not know her prior work. I kind of played the record sort of on a lark. I have a vivid recollection of that moment. And even though I maybe listened to other records more than Colleen's record this year, the sort of sheer novelty and shock value of engaging with her for the first time made me realize that I made me think I should put it on my list, because that value for someone who listens to music all the time as a job, the value of that shock of the new cannot be undervalued.
Power of the first impression.
Can you reproduce the expression that you had on your face the first time you heard it?
Sure. You want me to do it right now?
You see. That's kind of yeah. Yeah. That's kind of a,
It was a little Scooby-Doo-ish. Yeah. I felt like when I was looking, I have my 50 albums. I was like, oh, maybe I should put Tyler Farr at number 10. But like Tyler Farr didn't make me go, but Colleen like for sure did.
Yeah.
So there we go.
I support that.
So you want the head snapping album. I mean, that's what Mbangwana started for me, actually. Yeah. It's like, whoa.
So from Colleen's album, we will hear
Holding Horses.
So my wild card was a record by a Brazilian singer named Eva Rocha. I've probably been pronouncing her name wrong, but I believe this is how it's pronounced. Eva Rocha. A-V-A, last name R-O-C-H-A. She's from Rio, and she's part of a group of musicians that I just started noticing this year. But I feel like I'm more excited about this little group of Brazilian musicians than I have been excited about subcurrents in Brazilian music for quite a while. A lot of them have something to do either with a record label called Quinta Avant or a club that they often play at called Audio Rebel, or there's also a festival that intersects with these people called Novas Frequencias. Eva Rocha's album, Eva Patria India Iracema, is basically a first record. She made something before that was more like a band record, but this is more like a solo record. And it's a mixture of avant rock and sort of post bossa nova and serious music and noise. And there's always this tension between real arranged, composed stuff and chaos, sort of. But she's kind of she's the most approachable aspect of this little scene. She has quite a beautiful voice that sometimes sounds like Gal Costa's. It's a great record, which can be heard free from her website, evarocha.com, evarocha.com. And that was Auto das Bacanches by Eva Rocha from her record Eva Patria India Iracema. What a time to be alive, gentlemen.
Indeed.
What is alive, really?
It's
what
the is opposite time? Of dead.
That seems so literal, though.
I think I'll be seeing more of you soon. We'll be chatting about other topics to do with the calendar year 2015.
Count on it.
And thank you so much. Our excellent producers are Tamara Best and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can hear a lot of the music that we've been talking about on our Spotify playlist. Also, look at our lists so you know what we're talking about and you know how to spell what we're talking about at nytimes.com/music. Thanks so much.